Good evening and welcome to Stockwatch this Friday. And joining me for some stock pick analysis is Devin Shute from the Robert Group and Carl Hebers from Benguela Global Fund Managers as well. Welcome to you both and thanks so much for being with us this evening. So we had our guests this week choosing very topical stocks, and I say this because quite a few of them related to some of the major calendar events that were in play this week. The Fed, of course, was in focus as it announced some of its first steps to begin paring its pandemic era support. Within that context, Dricus Combrink saying he likes Spurbank because where accommodative easy monetary policy has been the name of the game, the Russian bank has been a lot more conservative. So let's take a look at some of the investment rationale he's laid out.
In a world where central banks have been printing money, the Russian central bank has been quite conservative. I view them as the most conservative G8 bank, central bank out there. They've got 15% debt to GDP, and they own, as a percentage of GDP, the most gold reserves of any major economy. So there's a lot to like about the Russian economy, and great way to get exposures through a cheap bank.
Devin, how are you feeling about this? I've got to confess right at the top, and not a bank I'm too familiar with. How encouraged are you by its positioning within this economy specifically?
Look, so I mean, I like conservative banks, and I think it's a really large market that Spurbank operates in. The scale of this bank is actually quite impressive, although we might not be as familiar with it as maybe some of our local banks and the US banks. It's the 15th largest bank globally. It's got 3 million corporate customers, 100 million individual customers. So it's operating at pretty decent scale. I think what's also good in the environment that it plays in at the moment, and this I think is partly what Dricus was alluding to, is that we've got a raising interest rate environment globally. Russia's raised their rates by over 300 basis points this year. So the banks stand to benefit from that through that positive endowment effect. I think also the bank seems to be quite innovative. They operate in an online marketplace that has tens of millions of customers. So yeah, you know, conservative bank, got the scale and, you know, conducive rates environments. I think it's an interesting proposition.
You know, looking at some of the third quarter numbers that landed, Carl, it increased its 2021 ROE guidance to above 23% from at least 22% earlier. It's raised its corporate lending growth forecast to 8 to 12% and now sees retail lending growing anything between 20 and 22% this year as well. Not that they were on a low base to start off with, so this certainly is very encouraging.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the positive things, besides very attractive valuation actually for the bank, is you're getting that attractive price at very good growth rates. So you're getting loan growth, they've got deposit growth, they've got very attractive net interest margins compared, you know, if you look at them, I think 5.5% compared to our banks that are between 3% and 4%, and very efficient. So I think, certainly the opportunities there to get a very attractive quality bank at a very attractive price. You're getting a dividend of 8%, PE of 6, you know, so that's almost a no-brainer. But I guess you have to look at the Russian risk. It is 52% government-owned, but I think, in terms of operationally and valuation, it looks very attractive.
How much do we have to pay attention, Devin, to some of the maneuverings that's happening in the background? Because the bank scaling down on its geographic footprint, right? It's already sold some of its operations in the broader CEE region and says that it's just going to be, homing in on the markets that matter for now.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not specific only to Spurbank. We're seeing around the world some banks looking to consolidate. So I don't think it's a concern if it allows them to focus more effectively on their target market. As I said in the first little bit of commentary, they've got sufficient scale to really matter. I think Carl hit the nail on the head in terms of country and possible political risk, maybe why it's has a cheaper rating than possibly other global peers. But definitely one to consider within the financial complex.
Okay, well, while central banks stole bulk off the attention this week, it was still very hard to pull the spotlight away from corporate earnings reports that surfaced. They kept coming through strong, so much so that both the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq were propelled to record highs this week. Qualcomm, Electronic Arts, rival Take-Two Interactive Software were just some of those on yesterday's list, but Wayne McCurry veering towards Samsung.
They came out with results. Results look good, but the biggest reason why, I mean, the future is not massively exciting, but the biggest reason why I'm optimistic is it's got a very low rating. It's only an 11 price earnings ratio. That seems reasonable for a company this size in a recovering global economy. So I'm going to go for Samsung.
Carl, strong pricing and demand coming up against supply chain issues. How are you weighing those factors up against each other?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the sort of memory space or the semiconductor space, we've seen that good pricing because of the shortage. I think over the medium term, that should be beneficial to companies like Samsung, because they, you know, the pricing is probably the element that can drive margins. The whole supply chain issue will probably remain in place for a while longer, so it'll stop them from growing volumes aggressively. But I think for them, it's probably going to be better to get that pricing through. We've seen their margins over the last 2 years have been under pressure. I mean, a lot of it COVID related in terms of their product sales and so on. But I think the outlook for the next couple of years does look attractive for them to, and mainly on the semiconductor side, to get the margins back up.
Yeah, let's drill into some of the details that around valuation, Devon, because something that Wayne highlighted, low rating, it's only at an 11 price earnings ratio. It's continued to underperform. It's remained about 4% lower over the last month, around 25% year to date. So, you know, what's holding investors back?
Look, I mean, I think that kind of stagnant share price is probably reflective of the last 5 years' revenue and earnings growth. Really hasn't done much. I think as a result, the market's ascribed a fairly low multiple to what is quite a diverse and enviable portfolio of products. I think, you know, those brands offer a significant moat to the industry. Yes, there are constraints at the moment. I do agree with Carl that I think you're going to see some margin expansion as those start to be relieved. I guess the question is where does the real growth come from? They've been struggling for the last 4 years. And, you know, the competition is stiff out there, particularly in the mobile communication and personal electronics space. So, you know, those strong brands, I'm not seeing enough for a big enough growth driver to give a higher multiple. Hence, possibly the affordable entry now.
So you don't see next-gen foldable smartphones moving the needle much?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's always a new innovation, right? And, you know, if it captures the imagination of the audience, that they do have a nice bump up. I think Samsung's got a lot of moving parts in terms of its division. Obviously, mobile is very important to it, and it's established there. I'm kind of a wait-and-see on this one, Alicia. I'm not convinced that you are going to see massive growth coming out from it in the medium term. But that being said, there is a large margin for error with the valuation you currently pay.
Okay, well, when it comes to technologies of the future, the clean green agenda is going to have to be one that they drive. We had COP26, a kickoff in Glasgow this week. Lots of big commitments having emerged from that already. And Stephen Schultz going with a company that may be old school, but is readying its arsenal for being future fit.
It's got around 75 electric vehicles, which it's looking to put forward as an arsenal by 2030. It's also investing heavily in European battery cell manufacturing, which expects to generate around 4 million cars worth of batteries by 2030. It is currently victim to some of the well-documented supply shortages and chip shortages. But for me, that just represents a very good opportunity to start accumulating Volkswagen shares.
Carl, let's look at this, you know, clean green agenda and how it's starting to, if at all, influence some of your investment strategy and some of the companies it's putting on your radar screen right now. Is VW potentially one of them?
Yeah, I mean, VW is one that, you know, it has to evolve from actually call it the dirty fuel business to the clean you know, Tesla type. I think in terms of, you know, the car companies have been quite slow in evolving, and I think Tesla sort of, you know, accelerated things because they see they have to compete now, because in you know, 5-10 years the combustion engine will, a lot of them highlight that they'll be phased out. So VW is certainly putting measures in place, and I think as Stephen was mentioning, there's a lot of R&D into products, into new vehicles that they're putting in. And I mean, within their sort of peer group, I think they are probably in some of the front runners, you know, obviously outside of a pure EV producer like a Tesla, but in terms of converting towards battery-powered vehicles. So I think they certainly do look attractive, but again, their business is still very heavily focused on the old school vehicles, and it'll require quite a bit of capital to get, you know, their product out there, their EV products.
Yeah. Devin, as Carl's highlighted, we've had these manufacturers slow to move, but that realization is hitting hard and fast now, and they're going to have to accelerate the pace as we venture forward on this. So how much buying opportunity are you seeing in a Volkswagen right now, bearing in mind that this is likely to become a very competitive arena as we progress?
Yes. Look, I mean, clearly the market's ascribing a lot of value to the future of EV. And the question is, how do these legacy or traditional manufacturers play in that space? I think what's possibly underestimated is that, you know, a big manufacturer like VW at the moment has massive production facilities set up and ready to go, as well as kind of omni-channel sales routes to get those cars to market. And now that's often hamstrung Tesla, you know, getting that production capacity to scale. These companies already have it. And if they're able to, you know, utilize that R&D to effectively roll out those EVs on those production lines at scale, my sense is that they're going to be formidable competitors. You're already seeing VW come into the Chinese market and seeing massive demand there. It's about to unseat NIO as the third largest EV manufacturer there behind Tesla and one other. So I think the game is on. I think, you know, the legacy players well know that the next 5 to 10 years, the landscape is completely transformed. And I think they've got a lot of the tools and, you know, the equipment necessary for them to compete effectively.
Yeah, well, sticking to the theme of becoming future fit, Sibanye-Stillwater taking another step this week to sealing yet another deal, getting further downstream exposure to the battery metals value chain. This was Makwe Masilela's pick this week, even before the announcement actually came through.
For the fact that the guy started as a small gold miner, then they went into PGM, then now they're more into most important minerals, which have to do with electric vehicles, which have to do with global warming. And the guys, if you look at their PE, it's much better than those of their peers when it comes to the precious metals and mining index. And also their dividend yield is better than compared to its peers. And I think they're covering the right commodities, and that should bode well for them going forward.
Carl, I'm finding it very hard to find those that are coming up against Sibanye-Stillwater and having that exposure in your portfolio right now. They're making, it seems, all the right moves. And we were talking about just that kind of market that a player like this is going to start feeding into, right?
Yeah, you have to give Neil Froderman and his team credit for, you know, to look ahead of where things, I mean, they're using, you know, the windfalls of the high PGM prices and gold prices to invest in the newer metals or newer products that are required in the new technology like batteries and so on. So I think certainly it's still small in their life, but the fact that they are doing this, they're first movers, you know, within the mining, the larger mining industry to do this, I think it will stand them in good stead. And you know, using the windfall from the PGM, the high PGM prices to do this, I think is a wise move. I think, you know, a frustrating part for Sibanye is that they're not attracting higher valuations. But I think what's made Sibanye up to, you know, to what it is today is also something that sort of hamstrung them a bit, given the high level of corporate activity. But I think once the market appreciates what they've done, that they'll certainly get a re-rating. But yeah, I think certainly a case for having it in your portfolio.
Yeah, it's nice to see this appreciation now starting to come through, Devon, because, you know, there's always been a lot of skepticism around miners spending in any commodity upcycle because they were just labeled as being too exuberant, you know, when the times were good. But this, I guess, pointing to how much it really does matter where you're putting that spend and that capital to work.
Exactly. I mean, it's easy to criticize them for spending at the, you know, near the top of a cycle. The reality is that that's when they have the capital to do so. I think that I would agree with the comments about Sibanye, you know, making kind of clever and meaningful acquisitions that aren't too big to add too much risk to the group. I think on the valuation perspective, investors just need to be careful when looking at PEs in this time of the cycle. I mean, you know, earnings are massively inflated, and so you're going to get very attractive looking PEs, and there's quite a big argument to, particularly in the resource companies that are so cyclical, to be buying high when they're high PEs and selling when they're low. So I think don't just on face value, because it's trading, you know, at a single low digit PE, that it's a steal. These commodity prices are cyclical and they can turn against you very quickly, and that PE will then move up. So just the point on that, I think the string of acquisitions does make sense. I think it's probably the right quantum. And you know, following the genius Stillwater acquisition in 2017, I think they've got the license to continue a bit longer.
Let's stack Makwe's pick up against Graham Frank's pick, and that was Implats.
I do think that the overall commodity prices, be it iron ore, be it the palladium platinum segment, will come down, but it's to what extent will it come down? Implats in particular is trading on a PE of 3.2 times at the moment. So, you know, the market is discounting a huge, huge reduction in a number of these commodity prices. And as I say, while I think they will come down, I think you've got quite a lot of fat built into the likes of an Implats share price.
So, Devon, let's focus on that, because it picks up on what you were talking about as far as PEs are concerned, 3.2 times. But in this instance, we had Graham highlighting that the market is discounting quite a hefty fall back in the prices that we've gotten used to up to this point.
Yeah, look, I mean, whenever you're looking at these kind of single commodity producers, you've got to take a view on what the underlying commodity is going to be doing going forward, because the producer's really just a gear play on that. And picking where PGMs are going short term is difficult. Long term, I think there's definitely an investment case, and market is pretty comfortable with that. I think the hydrocarbon economy is here to stay. My sense is that the market in short term may have got a little bit ahead of itself, but I think these companies have done well to steer themselves out of the real doldrums we saw, call it 5 years ago, to be more robust. Balance sheets are looking better. I think they've learned a lot of important lessons. But just understand that going into a company like this is cyclical, it's volatile, and it's going to follow the underlying commodity.
Would you be jumping in right now, Carl? What's your view on Implats?
If one looks at a PE of 3, as Devon said, like, you're looking at very high commodity prices, so that can quickly come back down to earth. And I think in terms of looking at commodity producers, we generally like to, or we prefer the lower cost producers. So in the South African context, probably prefer Amplats to Implats. Having said that, I mean, they are, you know, if commodity prices stay where they are, they certainly will continue to do really well. I think what one can highlight is, in terms of where the commodity prices are, is that management of Implats in particular want to have a target of 20 billion cash that they want to keep on their balance sheet. And that just gives you an indication of the cyclicality and them, you know, understanding that things can go south pretty quickly, so they need that buffer. It is a risky purchase, but Implats has done well over the cycle. It would be a preference of cost by picking Implats rather.
Okay, let's leave now the traditional mining sphere and shift gear to mining of a different kind, mining on the cryptocurrency scene. Yes, we can't ignore it. And Jimmy Mohaya putting Marathon Digital front and center for us, with the Bitcoin mining company's production having risen 23% in October when compared to the previous month.
Marathon at the moment is a mining company, so they mine crypto, they're involved in digital assets, they're involved in NFTs, they've created a digital asset marketplace, amongst other things. But what's interesting about Marathon is they're trying to be the biggest mining or crypto mining company in North America. They've invested heavily in mining. They're mining for themselves. They're mining for others. They've got top-class mining equipment and that sort of thing. And now the reason this becomes a riskier pick is because of the fact that you're looking at the crypto space. You're looking at Bitcoin. You're looking at markets that are currently very volatile. And so your price is going to be affected by the values of Bitcoin and the volatility associated with Bitcoin.
Okay, so let's get to grips with this, because investing in cryptocurrency is one thing, but investing in a company that's doing the behind-the-scenes work another thing altogether. Devin, has this been a company you've paid much attention to?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's one we know. You know, investors looking to get exposure into digital assets or crypto assets have the option to either buy the underlying coins or tokens directly. They can get exposure through an ETF, which can be a single or basket of cryptos, or through the miners themselves, and that's what Marathon is doing. I think, you know, again, it's similar to the resource space, is that the performance of any of these is based on the performance of the underlying commodity, which in this case is a cryptocurrency and Bitcoin for Marathon, because that's what they're mining. So, you know, when that coin is at all-time highs, this thing is going to be highly profitable. Mining is a scale game. They've got some of the highest hash rates in the US. And so as a result, when they effectively mine those Bitcoins then sit in their treasury. And as their value increases, so the business increases in value. And this business has massively outperformed Bitcoin, which is no small feat. I think kind of bringing it back, we like the ETF approach in the crypto asset space. We think particularly a basket, it de-risks having to pick a single cryptocurrency and the associated volatility with that. But we think in terms of digital assets and Bitcoin specifically as digital gold, we think there's an argument to be made for an allocation in clients' portfolios.
Yeah. On your side, Carl, how are you feeling about Marathon Digital? Because this is a company that says it's also going to have to scale quite quickly in order to keep up with the demand that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel quite terrible for not ever owning it, because it's up 130-fold since April last year. So, I mean, it's one of those new, you know, and, you know, the younger folk probably understand these kind of things better. And not that I'm old, but... you know, at the end of the day, as Devin said, it's a miner that mines cryptocurrency. So the it's a leverage play on crypto, and probably primarily Bitcoin in this case. So the market certainly likes it, and it's done pretty well. But again, you probably have to have a view on crypto and where it's going. So it's probably above my sort of knowledge level at this point in time.
Paul, don't be too hard on yourself. You live, you learn, and who says you can't teach an old dog new tricks, right? That's all part of the game. Well, if you just can't handle the volatility of the cryptocurrency space at all and support more so plain, good old-fashioned comfort, maybe David Shapiro's pick is more up your alley, because as David says, who wants to ignore Lindt?
I'm going for chocolate companies, Lindt or Mondelez. You know, Mondelez who make Toblerone, and Lindt who make Lindt. And why? It's because people have got so much money, even with prices going up and chocolate prices rising, they're still able to show some incredible profits. Just have a look at Mondelez's results out today. Very, very strong. And Lindt as well, you know. Who wants to ignore Lindt?
Carl, I feel like I have to throw this question to you now, seeing that it's, you know, more traditional type of asset we're looking at here. Has this been one to have whet your appetite?
I think from a quality point of view, I think certainly is a good business. I think it's done the share price has done exceptionally well over the last year. So it's certainly run hard. I mean, if you're a momentum investor, this would be one for you. But I think a lot of that growth that they are experiencing, it seems to be priced in. So it's on a 50 times forward PE multiple. But they are, you know, it's got high margins, very strong brands. Just on valuations, probably where I'd be a bit cautious. But yeah, certainly a good quality business.
Devin, I'd be lying if I didn't admit that I'm staggered every time I look at the prices of these chocolates. But I guess it appeals to a certain market, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a profitable business. You know, the margin they're able to charge their customers is pretty impressive. And, you know, Lindt, although maybe a limited portfolio of brands and really, really high-end luxury chocolate, I think they specialize and do that particularly well. I think that there's been a wall of consumer spending hitting the market, particularly coming out of the US over the last 18 months since COVID. I mean, I think US consumer spending's increased by $1 trillion during that period, which is massive. And a lot of that will go into luxury goods, and obviously Lindt is part of that. So yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a product a lot of us know and love. I would say that probably, you know, David mentioned Mondelez as well in his analysis. I would probably favor them just because of a more broad-based portfolio of goods as opposed to just the luxury chocolate. That being said, it's a quality company, done well, and delicious.
Let's leave it there, gentlemen. Thanks so much for having joined us on the line this evening. And with that, we've come to the end of this week's Stockwatch. We'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. From me, Alicia Seckham, and the rest of the team, have a great weekend. We'll be right back.